and welcome to Susie Explores, a podcast with me, Susie Collier. Today, my guest is the French-born New York City-based pianist Dan Tepfer. He's a really fabulous pianist. He's a truly innovative composer and has a mind that pushes the boundaries of what is possible to create. One of his creations is his Natural Machines project, which we talk about in this conversation. And at the end of this podcast, there's an improvisation which we created together using Dan's Farplay app, which enables musicians to play together in real time, despite being thousands of miles apart. It feels just lovely to see you once again.
Likewise.
What's interesting is that you were saying, as you were getting stuff ready, you were saying, it's just so interesting that there are so many different things that can go wrong with tech. Mm-hmm. I don't want to paraphrase you wrongly, but you said something like that. And I was really aware that as you were fiddling around saying, oh, I think that's what it is, I was thinking, it's interesting being me because something goes wrong with the tech. And my first instinct is to just say, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to solve this. But mm-hmm. I think you go into it just knowing that you will. Do you think that's because you have a leaning towards being able to solve such problems? Or do you think it's because you just have got the information that you need to solve the problems?
I think it's really entirely a question of experience. It's like I have faced problem after problem after problem. Sometimes, at the very last minute before a big concert. And it seems that, knock on wood, it seems that every time I've been able to find a solution. I mean, I remember one concert in Sweden, I was doing my project Natural Machines, which is this project where I've written computer algorithms that improvise with me and generate graphics at the piano, and where the piano plays all by itself too, because this is a Yamaha disc clavier. And the organizers said ahead of time that the piano they had was from the early 2000s. So that's a model of this clavier that is totally great for this project, mm-hmm. The Mark IV. And I showed up and it turned out that the model they had was from like 1989, like very, very first generation of disc claviers ever made. And there's one really key aspect of how they function that was just not workable for my project, which is essentially like, this instrument, when you play something, it sends MIDI to my computer saying this note was played, And when you send a command to it from the computer to the piano,
yes,
the piano plays that note, but it doesn't register that note as a note that was played. You see?
Yes.
It doesn't say to you again, oh, that note was played, because that's a note you sent to it, right? But these early models didn't distinguish between those two things. In other words, if you asked it to play a note, it would send you a message saying, oh, that note was played, even though that's not a note that you physically played.
Oh, no.
And so, I showed up, I always try to show up with a lot of time, like at least 4 hours ahead of the concert. To have a lot of time to work through potential problems. And basically, I immediately realized I had to write a lot of code to myself differentiate between the notes that I had played at the keyboard or the notes that I had sent to it. So that's just one example of like something, a problem I had to solve that I couldn't have anticipated very, very shortly before an important concert. But I mean, there have been hundreds and hundreds of problems. And I know that there are definitely problems that I won't be able to solve, but thankfully I haven't encountered them yet. But it's just amazing to me how many different problems can happen. I mean, it could go from just like, a problem with video cables being too long, so the video's not getting to the projector, to like the piano mover forgetting the little Wi-Fi dongle. That there are just so many little problems. So at the end of the day, when I do just a solo concert of like, jazz piano or the Goldberg Variations or something, I just show up on stage and I'm like, oh, it's amazing not to have to worry about any of that stuff.
I think that's so interesting, isn't it? That you can relax and just think, I can just go and play. But can you always differentiate at an early stage whether something is likely to be something really small that's been forgotten, or a detail that has just been overlooked, or whether it is likely to be global, as in 1989, we're not compatible. That's a global problem. And you realize that straight away, did you?
In that case, as soon as I saw the piano, I was like, oh yeah, this is not the right model. But I didn't know about this particular issue in terms of how they function very differently from later models. So that's something that I discovered, you know, as I started playing with it. And then I downloaded a manual from the 80s online that very fortunately had some pencil notes scribbled in the margins of the PDF that showed some secret functions that it had. That actually really saved the day. So I wouldn't say that, you know, I guess I always approach a problem with the optimistic idea that it is solvable, and I'll go as hard as I can until I've exhausted every possible option to solve it. And it's possible that at some point there just won't be a solution.
What are your anxiety levels like during the process of solving something that is definitely taking you a long time and you have definitely just got a certain time frame to sort it? Are you good at just letting go and just realizing that that's not going to help you at all? Or are you really human?
I love that question. First of all, yes, I'm really human. But I will say that for whatever reason, I'm definitely an adrenaline junkie. You know, I love doing extreme sports. I love doing, you know, mountain climbing, and I'm a kite surfer, and I'm long time, you know, pretty aggressive downhill skier. And I just love like thrills. And I think that experience of having to solve a difficult problem at the very last minute to me is a little bit similar in that way. It's like, I wouldn't even describe it as anxiety. I would describe it as like having to face something very scary. And I have to admit, there's something about that I actually enjoy.
Okay. So the fight or flight thing, you're definitely going to fight in there. But what about, if we think about...
Not a person, though.
No. With a person. No, absolutely not a person. Sorry, I didn't make that really clear. But what about the kind of chasing with regard to the adrenaline high, or chasing the excitement that comes with doing something that is risky? Because quite clearly, you know, you've got your free diving as well, and you've got your kite surfing, and people say all sorts of things about kite surfing. Oh, you know, it could be really, really dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And as for free diving, goodness me, words don't even express what you're actually doing. In fact, can you explain what you're doing when you're free diving?
Well, first of all, I'm just a novice freediver. I just did it once with my dear friend Martina, who actually teaches freediving, and she took me out in Hawaii. I had a concert there a couple months ago, and taught me. You know, she had me read the manual and really like taught me properly the basics of it. And so, yeah, I mean at the most basic level, you're without any gear. You know, you don't have any bottles or air or anything like that. And you just take a big breath at the surface, and then you swim down and you swim back up. But again, I'm a total novice, but I just love that. I love the minimalism of it. I really want to do this again. And I love, you know, connecting to your question about adrenaline. Mm. I love that it's essentially an activity where you have to be very judicious in how much you push your risk tolerance, because, you know, the further you go down and the longer it'll take to get back up. One thing that you have to know about freediving that most people don't know until they've done it is that down to about 10 meters, you're buoyant. As in, you go down, and if you were to just like not do anything, you would come back up because of the air in your lungs. Mm-hmm. You would float. But below 10 meters, there's so much pressure on you that your lungs are actually compressed to a smaller volume. And as a result, you just start sinking like a rock. So if you're diving deeper than 10 meters, the further you go down, you really have to work hard to get back up, because you're not floating at that point.
So presumably, you not only had to realize how much breath you had in order to survive, to get to the top. But you had to save something literally in your own tank to have the strength to pull yourself back up on the mm-hmm. on the rope that you were presumably attached to.
I wasn't attached to the rope. There are different types of freediving. And on the video that I posted where I swam through that wrecked boat at the bottom, it's essentially a discipline. Well, I'm not even sure this was officially part of any strict discipline, but it's a discipline where you can pull yourself down on a rope and then pull yourself back up on the rope. And that just takes a little bit less energy than doing it with your arms or fins.
Yes.
So it's a little easier. But you're not attached to the rope.
But you're not attached, but it is there. It's a present thing that mm-hmm. you know that you can rely upon. So yeah. Here's you having a new experience. You haven't had it before. You're really excited about doing it. You've been given some really thorough basic training and told to read the handbook, which you have done. And you're there, but you can't have an idea really about how your body is going to be when it gets below 10 meters and things are starting to compress and you are sinking like a stone. And so how do you decide sensibly? How do you weigh up the risk of being down there and you don't really know how much you need in order to get yourself back up to the surface? So how do you make that kind of decision?
Well, I think a couple ways. First is that you know, because my friend Martineau was teaching me and she's an experienced teacher, mm-hmm. we did this all very progressively. You know, we did first some much shallower dives and then some gradually deeper ones. And, you know, by the time I actually swam through the shipwreck, that was probably my 10th dive or something like that.
Oh, okay. That feels better.
Yeah. So in a single session, but like, you know, we're very methodical about slowly getting a sense of how it feels and also correcting things that I was doing wrong on the previous dives and just like gradually doing it in this more textbook kind of way. But I would say that, you know, at the end of the day, with freediving, as with everything else, there is a certain just intuitive, I would say almost spiritual sense in which we have to trust ourselves, or I guess we don't have to trust ourselves, but you may have the feeling that you can trust yourself. And if you do, I think you have to go with it. I mean, you know, you and I, we did a bunch of free improvisation in music. And how do you know that you can go for a certain thing and it's going to be nice? You know,
mm-hmm.
it's very similar, I think. Yes, of course, you could know from experience, you've done it before, but at some level, things are going to be different enough. And the best moment is going to be, it's going to feel fresh enough that you really are going for something that you're not asking yourself in the back of your mind, is it going to work out? You're just doing it out of kind of faith. And so I think, in addition to all the kind of conscious elements, like preparing for something methodically, or like, you know, learning your scales and learning how to do things, there always is this element also of just kind of faith or self-confidence or lack of fear that we have to embrace.
Okay, so there are so many thoughts that I have, but I think if we look at the first improvising that we did together, I think that's really interesting because, yes, perhaps as far as looking at the textbook is concerned, you have experience of improvising. And as far as I'm concerned, I have experience of playing. But what was really interesting was the fact that we'd never actually had a go at this together before. But we had quite a deep discussion about life and love and grief and all sorts of things. We really had, I think, plumbed to the depths way over 10 meters down. We really had. So I think it's interesting because you're right. There was no way that we could encounter that with a sense of fear. But I think we were taking not only the method of perhaps what we've known in our own playing and in your own improvisation, it was the experience of having talked about all these things. We brought all that to the table as well, which I think was really, I think it's really worth mentioning, actually.
Well, you know, one thing we haven't talked about so far in this discussion about, you know, faith or lack of fear, or going for it, shall we say, is when it involves another person. And then we're talking about trust. And trust is, God, it's such a deep thing, isn't it?
Yes.
But indeed, I think talking and connecting in other ways can lead to more trust in music. But it's all just going to be one element of it, right? Because you can have a deep conversation with someone and then not connect musically.
Yes.
That can happen as well.
Yes, completely. I don't think it's a fait accompli. I don't think it's just an absolute given. And I feel really grateful for that time. Because in a sense, doing that playing, having had that discussion, I think took us way forward many, many years in terms of our friendship. And I now feel, I felt that then when I came over to see you and I was in the room that you are in right now, which is this beautiful studio space, it felt as though we had known each other for a very, very long time. So that's a really interesting thing, isn't it? So there's method, there's textbook, but actually, you know, you talked about the almost the spiritual in the intuitive and the trust and all that was there. And I just think it's put years on us in a really good way.
Well, I think that's the magic of music, isn't it? I completely agree. I think having a musical experience with someone where you feel that communication is happening on an intimate, you know, almost magical level makes you just much closer as friends. I think that really is so powerful in that way. I'm very grateful. You know, in some ways, I mean, you know, I'm a jazz musician. Like that's how I identify, even though I also write computer algorithms. I do this algorithmic improvised music. I also make, you know, visuals, and I also play a lot of classical music. Even though all of that, I think of myself as a jazz musician. Mm. And there have been times in my life where I've focused so much on these, you know, I've also written works for orchestra and there have been times in my life where I've focused on these other elements, you know, what I would call like the outer branches of the tree, if the trunk of the tree is my discipline as a jazz musician, that I've kind of neglected the core competence of being a jazz musician. And the thing that's always drawn me super hard back to maintaining that competence is the feeling of incredible, profound, intimate connection with another human that is possible when you're in shape as an improviser in jazz. And so, you know, that makes it worth it to me to keep practicing, even if I don't have that many straight ahead jazz gigs nowadays. You know, I played for 12 years with Lee Konitz, who's one of the great jazz legends. And even though now he's passed away and I don't have that many concerts where I'm just playing like jazz, I keep practicing that. In part because it informs everything else I do, but also in part just to have that experience of deep and beautiful connection with another human.
Do you know that's really, really true? I know we all go through phases of feeling like practicing and perhaps not feeling like practicing. And for those who have not dipped into your 100 days of practice, I really, really would recommend that folks go there because that was so inspiring to me. And actually, since that time of looking at what you gave to the world each day, there has not been a day that's gone by without me practicing. And I think that needed to happen. And it's beginning to feel nice again. It's beginning to feel as though I have got ideas about really how I want to practice and what I want to do. And I'm based completely in the classical tradition and just really looking at brass tacks. You know, you talk about being methodical or looking at textbook. Well, I think you can't just imagine that it's going to happen. You do need to put in the effort.
Absolutely. I mean, I love the word practice. And we think of practicing as this thing that that you might do once. Like, what did you do today? Oh, I practiced. Mm-hmm. Well, no, that's not practicing. Practicing is a practice.
Yeah.
What is a practice? A practice is an activity that unfolds over time, over an extended period of time. That's kind of the definition of having a practice, right? We think of a meditation practice. It's not something you do once. And I think we tend to forget that about practicing in music, but that the real value of practicing music is when it is a practice. And even if you have a bad practice day, that is just as valuable as a good practice day, as long as you're in the chair practicing. So that's kind of how I try to think of it. It's like I have a practice. It's a spiritual practice. And it's not just practicing.
That's so beautifully put. And it's so inspirational, because in the same way that many folks talk about meditation as being a practice and how doing it once is just not going to be enough. And the idea is that however you're feeling, you can still come to that space and you can still experience something that is going to be really wonderful for your day. And that is exactly the same as practice. Absolutely. So however you're feeling, yes.
And, you know, and maybe some days you might have one that's not wonderful for your day.
Yeah.
That's frustrating. And that's just as good information as the one that is wonderful for your day.
Yes.
So it's just having a chance to observe that. I mean, I've learned a lot from bad practice sessions where, you know, then I come back the next day and I'm like, I've had an insight while I was sleeping as to what I was doing wrong. And almost always what I'm doing wrong is I'm pushing too hard.
Yes.
I'm lacking in humility. I'm lacking that humility of saying, you know what? I can't actually do this. So right. I need to slow this way down, or I need to break it down. It's almost always a lack of humility, which I think also would be what would lead to a less than stellar meditation session. Is like maybe you just want to have some great feeling, or you want to have some insight. And as a result, you're just not present. So having those bad sessions is super important too, in order to just be reinforced in what the ingredients are that make a good session.
But don't you think it's interesting if we're kind of looking at the different analogies we've talked about so far? So we've talked about the kind of risky, sporty kind of things, and we've talked about the musical thing. And I think it's interesting that you're saying, I'm just pushing too hard and I need some humility. Mm-hmm. But presumably we've got to be really gentle with how we describe things, because in a sense, when you do kite surfing or whatever it happens to be, you have kind of got to push hard in order to really understand your own limitations.
Yeah, I mean, this is really deep. And I think kind of core to my life, because I just my parents have always described me, even from like when I was a baby, as somebody who pushes boundaries. This is just kind of what I love to do. It's just what I do naturally, is like pushing against the walls, you know.
Yes.
And in fact, I made a record in, when was it, 2018, I think, called 11 Cages.
Oh yeah.
Which is my last trio record. And it's really all about this concept of, you know, that you put yourself in a cage. So in this case, the compositions themselves are cages. They're these constraints. They're these very tight frames. And then the game is you push as hard as you can against the walls of that cage. But the core belief behind it is that it's in the tightest cages that we sometimes are the most free, because total freedom is just kind of can be paralyzing.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, I think kitesurfing for me is a great example of something that has a lot of like adrenaline and fear attached to it. And it's a way of exploring what the limits of that are. And so, for example, you know, I'm 41. So if I were doing this when I was 18, I would probably be going way more crazy than I am now. And I realize that, and I'm kind of enjoying that I'm a little more staid about it. I mean, I recently I learned how to do a backflip, and just putting myself in that position. I've always wanted to do a backflip since I was a kid, and I just never learned how to do it. It's super scary to me. And just looking at that fear, super scary. The backflip is a great example because it's so simple. It's just a thing you do, you know. Looking at that fear, and then also asking myself, like, how much of that fear is justified? Well, in the case of the backflip, fair amount. You know, you can really hurt yourself falling on your neck or whatever. But also how much of it is unhelpful. I find that really fascinating. So in other words, I'm being very circuitous here in my consideration of your question, but I think fear is a fascinating topic, and putting oneself in positions where one has to look at one's fear from different perspectives, I think is an amazing window onto one's life. And I just hope to keep doing that all through my life.
I also think that fear is an interesting one. And I think that fear gets gets bad press. It just does. Because we just think, oh, we fear it. We've just got to keep away. We must keep away from what we fear. Don't like that. Not going near it. I really do fear it. And I think a lot of us just feel that, well, I've acknowledged my fear. That's really, really great. Now I'm going to run away because I've decided that I'm not going to look at it. But we're having to make decisions every single day about whether we face a fear or whether it isn't quite the right time. And we've gone a little bit too far. And today is not the day for the backflip. Okay. I'm realizing it's like a bad practice day. I'm not feeling it in my body. This isn't a good day to drive forward with that. So isn't it interesting that actually you've got to be super in tune with yourself and super humble to realize that sometimes you may make the wrong decision with regard to fear in the moment. You may go for it and perhaps it wasn't the most sensible, or you may run away from it and you afterwards you might think, well, I could have done it. Nothing's a wrong decision, but we're weighing it up the whole time. It's really nuanced, isn't it? Fear.
It's amazing. It's a tightrope. It truly is a tightrope.
Yeah.
You know what I love in this discussion is, and you just put it very beautifully, is the distinction between the words courage and recklessness.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a very fine line. I mean, and often the the distinction is almost something you make in retrospect. Right?
Yes.
If somebody did something that, if it ended badly, could have been termed recklessness, but actually ended up ending well.
Yes.
People may describe it as a courageous act.
Yes.
But vice versa. But I think in the absence of looking at it in hindsight, I think you're absolutely right that at the base of it, and this is what interests me in these activities where you have to face your fear, at the base of it is the necessity for being present with oneself and really listening to oneself and just having a sense of what one is authentically in phase with and what one is not. And that's actually something I feel very much when recently I was like trying to do a backflip on the beach. I was just like really feeling exactly that distinction. But, you know, I think fear for me operates in a lot of different ways, because you think of the backflip, I mean, you really can break your neck, right?
Yes.
But how about when I'm on stage, or we're all on stage, but I'll talk about myself specifically. I'm on stage doing this program that I've been doing for 10 years called Goldberg Variations, where I play the Goldberg Variations by Bach. I play them from memory, you know, as most classical pianists do when they perform them. It's this epic work that I've learned from speaking to classical pianists is scary for them as well. Mm-hmm. And then After each one of the 30 variations, I improvise a variation of my own. So it's like, you know, it's a really intense kind of marathon-like undertaking for me. And not only that, but I've studied classical piano since I was a kid, but not in the way that the people who are at the top of, you know, the classical world have, where it's just been this like Olympic level training their entire life. Like, I've really thought of myself as a jazz improviser most of my life, even as a kid. So I'm on stage and I'm terrified. I'm absolutely terrified. I'm less so now because I've done this hundreds of times now.
Okay.
But I can tell you that the first years of doing this program, I was utterly terrified. And it was having all kinds of effects, like my body would be tight.
Of course.
You know, and if your body's tight, you can't play with a good sound, and you certainly can't, you know, express yourself fully musically. And so that was fear, that was terror. And at some point I had to really ask myself, is this fear helping? That's another interesting question with regard to fear, right? as you were saying, sometimes the feeling is, oh, I'm scared of that, so I should run away.
Yes. Right?
But it's really interesting to ask oneself, is this fear actually warranted? Or is it, am I being triggered because of something in my past? And the thing itself maybe isn't as scary as I think it is. And what I realized is that if I, you know, I use Alexander technique, which I think is a wonderful practice, is something I've gotten really into. It's been very helpful. But if I breathed into my lower back in these moments when my body was so tense, suddenly the world started looking very different. I mean, truly, this thing that seemed incredibly scary and terrifying suddenly seemed less so. And so I realized that this feeling I had about the thing, which is that objectively, this is scary.
Yes.
That's my feeling. It's like, this is scary. There's no doubt that it's scary. It's terrifying. I realized that by simply adjusting something in my body, it seemed different. And that made me realize, well, no, that wasn't a truth that is scary. It's just a matter of perspective. The thing itself actually isn't scary. So that was incredibly liberating for me. And when you're talking about playing music, nobody's going to die. You're not going to break your neck. I mean, it is terrible to play a bad concert. It really is awful. Mm. I find it very depressing. Mm. But that's kind of the worst that can happen. So I think in the context of being a musician, being creative, fear is even more interesting and more nuanced than it is when you're talking about something, you know, very explicit, like doing a backflip.
Well, it's lovely to be able to link it all up, really. But I wonder, because you did allude to the fact that, you know, actually, when you're terrified and your body is tight, and it just means that it's just hard to express. And I think it's hard to express in words as well as in music. It's just difficult. You're literally being kind of paralyzed by your own fear. And you said that perhaps it may have something to do with something that's old, a fear of old. And I wonder, because your premise, if I understand you rightly, when you started talking about the Goldberg variations, was that you're not like the world-class pianists of this world. You haven't had that background, you know, because...
World-class classical pianists, yeah.
Exactly, because I identify as a jazz pianist, so it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. Do you think mm-hmm. that is where some of the fear came from? Do you understand why it was there? I mean, I think it's a marathon. It's an absolute marathon, just thinking about that concept. It is a marathon. But do you think that was some of the fear?
Yeah, I think probably a degree of the fear had to do with feeling like I didn't necessarily belong. Mm. But on the other hand, you know, there's this great Maria Callas quote where she says, nerves are simply the result of inadequate preparation. Pretty hardcore, you know, and she was a very, very hard worker. When she was taking voice lessons, she would not only go to her own lessons, but she would attend all the other lessons that her teacher was giving.
Yes.
And learn from those as well, just as a spectator. Very, very hard workers, very hardcore. So I think in some respects, this fear that I had was also a legitimate reflection of the fact that this was a huge stretch for my abilities as a pianist, because I just had no experience playing classical concerts of works that challenging in public. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something about it that's very legitimate. And you know, I wasn't, in some ways, it's not that I'm saying the fear is unjustified. The question I'm asking is the fear helpful?
Yes. So can we ask ourselves that question in any situation? So any situation in life, is there the space in a situation in which you feel fear to ask yourself that question?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And to, you know, go back to something physical, I love jumping off cliffs. Mm. And, you know, you stand there above the water, at the top of a cliff. It's very scary. I mean, just at a really raw level, right? And I'm, you know, my undergrad is in physics. I'm somebody who identifies with the scientific process mm-hmm. a lot. I love the idea of, investigating things and coming to conclusions that have objective truth to them, right? Mm. So if I look at that fear that I have when I'm at the top of the cliff, there are elements of it that are extremely justified. Like, okay, do I know that there isn't, that there aren't sticks? Do I know that it's deep enough?
Yes.
At the bottom, that I'm not going to hit something when I hit the water. Do I know that there aren't sticks down there? Do I know for sure that, you know, somebody else isn't jumping from somewhere else? So all these elements that I think are incredibly healthy fears, but often we don't identify them. Often we just feel this paralyzing fear and we don't break it down. So in this context, what I'll do is I'll be like, well, it'd be foolish to jump without knowing the answer to these questions. So I'll just go down and look at the water and, you know, dive down and be absolutely 100% sure in this kind of like objective truth kind of way that element of the fear has been resolved, you know? And so then I'll go back up.
Yes.
And the remaining fear is purely like reptilian, right? I've satisfied the kind of healthy, sane, rational elements of the fear. And now it's just reptilian. And that I find very freeing. It's like, I know rationally that this is going to be okay. And this fear I can just breathe into and be okay with it.
Oh, I think this is so amazing. I find that this is really speaking to me, and I know that other people are really going to benefit from hearing your words. I love the idea of within fear, there are the unanswered questions, and you can actually try and find out what you can. And then at the end, you've got some residual fear. And maybe it is true that in certain situations, there remain some unanswered questions.
Of course.
Because in that situation with the cliff, I mean, you still can't guarantee that somebody isn't going to be jumping off from a different place, or that sticks don't kind of come along at that moment and disrupt your fall.
I think you can guarantee both those things. Like you could look very carefully around and satisfy yourself, depending on the situation, that there's literally no possibility. There's no other place that somebody could jump. And if there's not a lot of current, you could satisfy yourself that there's no possible way that a stick could come around, or that literally there just aren't any sticks around. I wouldn't jump unless I could satisfy myself that these two things were true.
Okay, so I think that's really interesting, because you very quickly and very naturally answered my question, which was, what happens when there are the unanswered questions? And you said, well, actually, I think that I really can make some positive decisions about the situation I'm jumping into.
But there are always other unanswered questions. I mean, for sure, like, you know, am I sure I'm not going to rotate too much in the air and you know, fall on my back or something like that? I mean, I guess for me, I'm just not experienced enough as a cliff jumper to be absolutely sure. So that's one thing where I'm just like, okay, got to be really careful about that. But, you know, to come back to Maria Callas, nerves are a result of inadequate preparation.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken, she did have nerves before going on stage. Mm-hmm. And even though she was very, 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 very well prepared. And so maybe, I don't know, I shouldn't put words in her mouth, but I think one thing's for sure is that many great, great artists still experience nerves, even though they might be, you know, immaculately prepared. And so we just can never be 100% prepared. There are always going to be unknowns. I mean, if you're a singer, you know, you could, well, many things could happen. It's such a complex instrument. So yes, I mean, we can prepare to a reasonable degree, but there's always going to be unknowns. And I think that's part of what makes live performance so wonderful. And that's what we miss in a recording or at the movies, is that danger. In fact, I think there needs to be danger for a live performance to be good. I really believe that strongly, in the same way that if you're watching, you know, a surfer on a wave, if there isn't a possibility that they'll fall, it's just boring.
I really like it, because you're dissing the ideas that I think a lot of us carry, that fear is a terrible word and danger is a terrible word. And actually, as I understand it, and I really, really feel very similar to you, that we need these things. We need both those things. Actually, to be creative, actually, to be curious, actually, to do anything that pushes our boundaries of experience.
I know I do. I can't speak for everyone, but I think it is a natural part of being an animal on this planet, is being faced with unknown situations in which you might discover new things about yourself, because you wouldn't have willingly exposed yourself to this thing. But since you are exposed to it, you realize, oh, I react this way, or it's part of being alive. I think it's a fundamental part of being alive. And in fact, you know, maybe there's something that you're getting at, which is that maybe our current society, this belief that we should never be in danger or that we should never feel fear, maybe that is limiting our lives somewhat.
Well, I think it's interesting, historically, when people will say, oh, well, those who were around in the world wars, you know, they knew how to face danger, and they knew what hardship was. And then, oh, the generation that came afterwards, it was all very, very soft and easy. And, oh, those who were around and teenagers in the pandemic, well, they feel like this and they're not prepared for the world or whatever it happens to be. And I think it's just interesting that as we look through history, it seems that there have been times in life where we've really had to embrace danger and risk. Mm. More times than others.
That is really interesting. And it has an impact on people, and it has an impact on art. Yeah, not sure exactly what to say about that. When I think of the wars and this utterly unnecessary suffering that humans impose upon themselves in the act of fighting, I feel nothing but sorrow. And in fact, you know, I think this is one of the wonderful things about peaceful human society is, you know, people have developed these sports that are a sublimation of battle.
Oh, yes, 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 very true.
People also, you know, when they're in business type situations, it's very much a battle, but that doesn't involve death. And that hopefully actually leads to some kind of mutual betterment, even though there are winners and losers, the society as a whole benefits in a way that society doesn't from war. So I guess what I'm trying to say is we're talking about danger and fear. And I think as humans, we probably need that, I think. But hopefully we can continue to develop ways to channel those needs into nonviolent outcomes.
I think not only nonviolent outcomes, but it'd be really lovely if we could channel that unbelievable amount of strength into making our society a way more connected one. Because I think it's very easy to think about the battles that you fight within a sport or within business. But actually, I think that the way we encompass battle or embrace battle does actually have the potential to make for a more connected society.
Yeah, well, it is interesting how if you sublimate the fight, fighting with someone can actually make you feel very close to them. Mm. You know, like playing a game of tennis with someone, which is very much a fight, or a game of chess, which is a really hardcore fight.
Yeah.
You are battling, but you come away usually with a feeling of respect and closeness, because that also, in the same way that playing music together, can be quite an intimate experience where people are kind of revealed at their rawest. So we need that fight. I'm sure of that. Oh, you know, the other day I went to the Brooklyn Zoo, the Prospect Park Zoo.
Oh, okay.
In Brooklyn here, and there's this little zoo in Prospect Park. It's like not
I walked
at all
by
little...
it. I walked by it. It was I could hear all sorts of noises from outside.
Yeah, exactly. All these animal noises. Yeah. And it's just this little zoo. It's a humble zoo. But they have some great stuff in there. They have sea lions. My favorite quote unquote exhibit, I kind of hate to use that word, but that they have there is they have a family of baboons.
Oh.
And these baboons, there must be 12 of them or something like that. And they are so human-like, you know, I mean, to the point that it's it's actually, there's something very strange about observing them in this enclosed environment. I feel like real empathy for them and kind of feel weird about them being in captivity. But anyway, that's a separate question. But you look at them and you know, we share like 99% of our DNA with baboons, or is it 98%? Anyway, it's a huge amount. And you can just relate to them so naturally in terms of how they're interacting societally. And one of the things that blows my mind is both times I've been there, I mean, I can watch them for hours. And both times I've been there, it's constant drama. They're, you know, they're shifting around this relatively large space they have, creating little cliques, creating alliances. And then occasionally, like, these cliques will find reasons to stare at each other and bare their teeth. And then sometimes they'll actually, like, have a fight.
Yes.
But they never actually hurt each other, right? And I'm just thinking, these animals are in here every day.
Yes.
And for years.
Yes.
And this is just what they do every day, you know? So clearly, this is just built into us, this fundamental constant reevaluation of the structure of society. It's just like constantly these forces are operating that, like, you know, challenge who's on top, you know, who's friend. No, right? It's always fluid, and there's always this fighting happening. I guess, you know, when you see, you know, we all know families where there's just constant fighting and breaking of plates and all this stuff. I do more and more think of these, again, sublimated ways of fighting that humans have developed as just such a beautiful thing. It's just, you know, it's a way of not breaking the plates. It's a way of not screaming. It's a way of getting that aggression out in this actually positive way. It's pretty amazing when you think about it.
I think it is. But don't you think it's also amazing that, as I see it, people are lauded for being really even with their kind of temperament and just kind of calm all the time, and nothing really phases them. And you speak to couples who've been together for all their life, and some will say we fight like cats and dogs, and lots of others will just say we've never had a crossword. It's almost something to be really, really proud of. And yet, perhaps with the exploring that we're doing today, well, I'm certainly realizing afresh that it's wonderful to have the highs and lows, and it's wonderful to feel that there is friction and you're not just kind of holding it in and repressing it and not talking about it in a very British way, but more baboon-like. You're saying, do you know something? There is this thing. I think we just need to sort it and then leave it behind.
Yeah, that is actually one of the big things I took away from looking at the baboons, is they're just so self-expressed, you know? They're not holding it in.
No.
And, you know, I think that's something that can happen with humans. We hold it in, and then all of this, we're dragging all this luggage behind us, all this baggage behind us. And I don't think they're doing that.
No, I don't think they're doing that either. And that's a really beautiful thing. It's kind of, I want to leave that thought in the air because it's so important. I know that time's going on. I really realize that. And but there are two kind of areas I just want to just delve into just for a minute. One is what you've done with natural machines. And once again, if those who are listening have not experienced what you do to really draw the senses together and to really activate every part of the audience on whatever level they come, that you're really, really feeding them in all sorts of different ways. I'm wondering whether I could just put you on the spot and just say, look, okay, there's 30 seconds. Why don't you say something using whatever algorithms you want right now? And play something. And for those who will eventually be able to watch this, they'll be able to see what is actually visually happening. Would that be all right?
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I've developed all these different algorithms for natural machines. And you know, natural machines, the title itself connects very much to some of the topics we've explored here, because it's really about the meeting of the natural and the mechanical.
Yes.
And by the natural, I mean, you know, these spiritual and emotional and intuitive feelings that we have as humans. And then by the mechanical, I mean these logical, rational mathematical ideas that can be incredibly useful in the creation of art. So especially if you think of the music of Bach, for example, but most great musicians have used logical systems to support their art and to frame their intuition. So this project, Natural Machines, I've come up with a whole bunch of different logical systems that the computer then runs in response, in direct response to what I'm playing. And I find them these incredibly inspiring little playgrounds to play around in. This is, everything I do in this project is free improvisation. That's the idea behind it. It's like, instead of writing a piece, I write the way that a piece works. So it's like writing these modes of functioning as opposed to what the actual content is going to be.
But presumably you know the modes of functioning better than your family. You just know them so well that you kind of know how they're going to behave in any situation, when they're going to feel like having an argument with you, when they're going to be much more passive, when they're going to be changing mood. You kind of get that because you know them and you inhabit them. So yes, it's really true. You're going to be playing something that you have never played before. But it is also true that as the creator of these things, you kind of, you know them really well. And presumably you know most of their capabilities.
Yes, they still manage to surprise me here and there. And I would say that I've realized over time that in order for this music to function well, I have to listen to what the computer's playing in response to what I'm playing as if it were another person.
Right.
I have to listen to it as if it were the freshest thing in the world, because the minute I get complacent with it, the minute it just becomes kind of decoration, then this all really kind of falls apart. It needs to feel like an equal partner. And so it becomes a real kind of listening exercise for me.
Oh, isn't that just amazing? Look at all the things that you've brought up that really equate to life, because it's essential. It's just so essential to listen, and not only to listen, but to listen actively. And I think when we do that and we really respect the other person or the computer, then something different comes back that feels organic.
Absolutely.
and authentic, to come back to your word.
So, listening is that's maybe the most important thing in life. I don't know. It's certainly very, very high on the list. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to improvise with this tremolo algorithm.
Thank you so much. I can't believe that you can, I can't believe that you can draw in that way.
It is like drawing, right?
It's so lovely. But you're aware of, you're aware of what the sound could be in any given situation, but you're constantly evaluating what things look like, and you're thinking about how the shape of things will actually be visually. And that to me is, that's heaven on earth, that is, because you're able to create in many more ways than one. And that means that as somebody who is taking in your art, I can take it in a number of different ways as well. I have a choice.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. Yeah.
It's how I...
That is what I hope for, is a kind of a synesthetic experience, you know, where the exact same information, information of the music is hitting us in via two different senses at exactly the same time.
At exactly the same time. That's the thing.
So instead of distracting from the music, hopefully the visuals actually enhance the music and actually allow us to get more lost in it and to envelop us even more.
Yes. But if you weren't able to see it and you're just listening to this podcast, you will have so been able to experience something deep and meaningful even without the visuals, but it is lovely to experience both. So listen, Dan, I have one more question for you. And the question is simply, what do you dream of finding, or what do you dream of doing in the future that you haven't done as yet? And it's a really broad question. So you could take it musically, you could take it in life, you can take it in whatever way. But for somebody who is really always pushing at the boundaries and really challenging yourself, I wonder what you truly crave in your future.
Honestly, I think that the biggest thing for me right now at this point in my life is I would like to have a family. I think that'll probably be, you know, I keep having musical adventures, and that's really key for me. That'll never stop. Musical, but also just artistic adventures. And as you know, I have this startup called Farplay. We make this app where musicians can play music together through the internet with the lowest possible latency. And you and I did this,
which is what we did. Yes,
London, between London and Brooklyn. So those are kind of ongoing adventures. But I think having a family would be the biggest one for me. I just really feel that's something that I want to have in my life. So we'll see what happens with that.
You've been so, so very honest, and you haven't shirked any question I've asked, and we've been able to really plumb the depths as ever. It's happened every single time we've ever had a conversation. But I do want to just say thank you so much for another lovely conversation, and I can't wait until we have one again.
Well, thank you, Susie. It's such a pleasure. I don't know how you do it, but somehow these conversations feel very different from your typical interview. So it's really wonderful how you're able to be so disarming, not only with me, but with your other guests. So it's a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking more and playing more as well.
Without a doubt. Until next time.
Thank you.